Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to another hour of discernment on the February 24th, 2019. I did a broadcast about a week ago on a book review. It's called The Myth of German Villainy by Benton L. Bradbury. And I wasn't pleased with it, and see if I can do a better job on the second time through. But first, I'd like to play a song. You know, what we're experiencing right now is a miracle. Every breath of air, what is life about? You know, in this little song, it's 3.5 minutes. It's on the country western side, but it's life in 3.5 minutes. So I'm going to play the song, and then I'll start the broadcast after this song. It's loading up.
Walked into the bar and parked his lanky frame upon a tall bar stool. And with a long, soft southern drawl, said, I'll just have a glass of anything that's cool. A barroom girl with heart and knowing eyes slowly looked him up and down. And she thought, I wonder how on earth that country bumpkin found his way to town. He said, hello, country bumpkin, how's the frost out on the pumpkin? I've seen some sights, but man, you're something. Where'd you come from, country bumpkin? It was just a short year later, in a bed of joy-filled tears, yet death like pain. Into this wondrous world of many wonders, one more wonder came. That same woman's face was wrapped up in a raptured look of love and tenderness. As she marveled at the soft and warm and cuddly boy child feeding at her breast. She said, hello, country bumpkin, precious frost out on the pumpkin. I've seen some sights, but babe, you're something. Mama loves her country bumpkin. 40 years of hard work later, in a simple, quiet, and peaceful country place. The heavy hand of time had not erased the raptured wonder from the woman's face. She was lying on her deathbed, knowing fully well her race was nearly run. But she softly smiled and looked into the sad eyes of her husband and her son. She said, so long, country bumpkin, the frost is gone now from the pumpkin. I've seen some sights and life's been something. See you later, country bumpkin. She said, so long, country bumpkin, the frost is gone now from the pumpkin. I've seen some sights and life's been something. See you later, country bumpkin.
Well, you might kind of ask yourself why I chose that song for this. Because we're living in a time We're living in a time where people are not seeing what's really life and the real blessings of life. In that little song, a man meets a woman, they have a child, and they live a life. And he was just a country bumpkin. And that's what I'm 70 years old, and my generation, we're probably the can see what we've lost in the last 50 years here in this country and in the world with the new technology, the simple things in life, like the birth of a child. You listen to the song once, but I've listened to it many times. I'm going to play it at the very end. Understand that song is just a cycle of life that God has given us. But tonight, I want to talk about a book review. And it's about a book, The Myth of German Villainy by Benton L. Bradbury. You know, I was born in May 1st, 1944. There was another year to go in the war. My dad was overseas in Germany. And he came back a whole lifespan, passed away, with us ever really talking about what really was happening in our world. And before we start this, this is a touchy subject with a lot of people, because understand, we have not been given what really happened in World War I and II. But this is the myth of German villainy that was started before World War I, and it still goes on today. So I want you to just open up our minds and listen and try to get rid of all what we've heard about World War II. Let's talk about what really happened. I'll say before we start, 46% of America have German blood running in their veins. And one time a man asked me when I was building B equipment, he says, come in. He said, say, Walt, he said, your dad's German, isn't he? And I said, yeah. He's Lutheran too, isn't he? Yeah. He said, why was he over in World War II killing Lutheran Germans? And I'll tell you the truth. At the time that was told to me, I knew it had an answer, but I didn't have it. So let's open our minds, and this is really a touchy subject, so I'm going to read the preface of this book. I mean, before we start, I want to have this on our mind. It's about a lie. It's a lie. It's a definition of a lie. Mightier than the nuclear bomb. The lie is Satan's most powerful weapon. The bomb merely devastates. The lie steals the soul. It enlists millions of naive people to Satan's cause. You know, when we steer off of God's word onto man, you know, for we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of the world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. So when I start this little book review with one chapter, I'm going to read a chapter. Let's realize that them Germans over there had children, husband and wives. And my dad went over to kill German Lutherans. Now, I'm not saying anything against my father. When we finally understand what really happened and how nasty war really is, it shakes us to our boat, right down to the pavement. So I'm going to start with his preface. Bradley, Bradley, his last name is Benton L. Bradley. This is his preface out of his book. He said, I served in the United States Navy from 1955 until 1977, mostly as a Navy pilot, and saw a lot of the world as a result. Aircraft carriers on which I served regularly visited European ports, as well as other ports around the world. I have also traveled extensively in the years since leaving the Navy. After traveling around most of Europe, Germany emerges as my favorite country. During our visits there, we found the German people to be pleasant, industrious, disciplined, and civilized, with many similarities to the traditional Americans. They in no way resemble the stereotypes depicted in all the anti-Nazi movies, books, and articles we have been subject to over the years. I am 74 as I write these words. My generation grew up and virtually inundated with anti-German propaganda. We were taught, quite literally, to hate the Germans as a people. Yet Germans I have met or befriended through the years seem no different from our Europeans or even Americans. And they seem no more inclined to violence and militarism than anyone else. If anything, less. I have never detected anything that might be considered wrong with the German character. They are a highly cultured, highly civilized people in every respect. When studied objectively, even Germany's leaders of the 1930s and 40s were not very different from other European leaders. They were only made out to be different by the relentless hate propaganda directed against them. Germany suffered more than any other country by far as a result of World War II. Some 160 of her largest cities and towns were completely destroyed by the Allied bombing campaign. And perhaps as many as 20 million Germans lost their lives as a result of the war. Yet no one wants to hear their tales of suffering, and no sympathy has been allowed the defeated and disgraced Germans. The anti-German propaganda has cultivated the general feeling that they got what they deserved. The entire responsibility for starting both wars and for all the death and destruction resulting from them has been assigned to the Germans. In parentheses, though, the facts don't bear that out. Because they were the losers of both world wars, they were never permitted to present their case before the world. The world court, nor to tell their side of the story through any medium. The winners of the wars often all write the history books. Neither did the true story of what happened during the war come out in the Nuremberg trials. The Nuremberg trials were nothing more than Soviet-style show trials, which violated every standard of traditional British and American justice. The purpose was not to discover guilt or innocence, but to spread a legal gloss over a decision which had already been made to execute German leaders. The entire Nuremberg circus was a sham and travesty. The anti-German propaganda used to create the climate of hatred that made the massive destruction and the mass slaughter of German civilians possible continued relentlessly along after the war was over, when it would seem natural for sober-minded historians to begin to moderate their extreme views about Germany. The fantastic atrocity stories continue even today. One needs only to tune into the History Channel to see them repeated again and again. In contrast, World War I was not long over before the atrocity stories attributed to the Germans during the war were exposed as the deliberate lies they were. Responsible men conducted thorough investigations and found that none of it was true. All the lurid stories were deliberately fabricated to win British public support for the war against Germany, and also to bring America into the war. But a different factor was in play after World War II to keep the phony horror stories alive, which did not exist after World War I. After World War II, the Jews exploited the anti-German world sentiment, which they themselves had largely created with their propaganda, to justify the creation, the creation, their long sought after state of Israel as a homeland for the Jewish people. Though manipulation of the international information media, the Jews won worldwide sympathy for themselves with their sensational stories of unique Jewish suffering at the hands of the cruel Germans. They claimed that Germany had followed a systematic plan to exterminate all of Europe's Jews, and that by war's end had managed to kill 6 million of them. The alleged method was to round the Jews up from all over Europe, haul them in trains to so-called death camps, where they were herded into gas chambers and killed, and their bodies then burned in giant crematories, with conveniently no forensic evidence of what happened left behind. In the absence of forensic evidence, eyewitnesses' testimony, no matter how bizarre, suffered to convict Germany and to make her the parent of civilized nations. The judges at Nuremberg trials were themselves not immune to the torrents of anti-German hate propaganda and were already predisposed before the trials ever began to believe any horror story, no matter how fantastic, about the Germans. Another factor which preordained the outcome of the trials was that the accusers also served as investigators, prosecutors, and final judges. The trials were also premeditated throughout with an atmosphere of Jewish vengeance seeking. Behind the Gentile frontmen, most of the lawyers, prosecutors, investigators were Jews. Hundreds of Jews who could barely speak English disported themselves in American Army officer uniforms. Two of the eight Nuremberg judges were Jews, Robert Falco of France and Lieutenant Colonel A.F. Voltker, real name Berkman of the Soviet Union. The general prosecutor for the High Court was Dr. Jacob, a Jew. Their dominance and control of the trials was blatant. Even the hangman for the 10 Nazi leaders sentenced to death, Master Sergeant John C. Wood, was a Jew, and the hangings took place on October 16, 1946, the Jewish holiday of Purim. In the Book of Esther, the 10 sons of Haman, an enemy of the Jews, were hanged on Purim Day. According to Louis Marchiklow, a wartime Hungarian journalist who wrote about the trials, quote, out of the 3,000 people employed on the staff of the Nuremberg courts, 2,400 were Jews. The Holocaust story that we all know so well today during the Nuremberg trials. By carefully cultivating and propagating this Holocaust story, the Jews have been able to extort hundreds of billions of dollars out of Germany and the United States, much of whom was used to fund the new state of Israel. The claim that Jews in Israel made the desert bloom was true. They did it with German and American money. They are now hard at work extorting more billions out of other European countries, in which has been contemptuously but correctly called the Holocaust industry. Even now, more than 500,000 so-called Holocaust survivors living mainly in Israel and the United States receive lifetime pensions from the German government. And what is a Holocaust survivor? Any Jew who lived anywhere in Germany, controlled territory at any time during the war, whether living in a concentration camp or in the lap of luxury, is a Holocaust survivor. and therefore eligible for German pension. Moreover, any Jew who was forced to leave Europe during the Nazi era is a Holocaust survivor. Christian survivors of the war, no matter how horrific their experience, are not eligible for pensions. Shoah is the Hebrew word for Holocaust. It has been joked around that, quote, there's no business like show business. The entire Holocaust racket has become nothing so much as a vast shakedown of European countries, especially Germany. The Holocaust story has other uses as well. It is routinely invoked to disarm the general public from defending itself from Jewish predations. Prime Minister Netanyahu regularly invokes the Holocaust to justify Israel's attacks upon its neighbors. Keeping this gravy train moving requires the continuing legitimization of Jews as history's ultimate victim group, which in turn requires an ultimate victimizer of the Jews in Germany has been designated to fill that role in perpetuity. The Jewish controlled history channel, or the Hitler channel, as it's sometimes derisively called, owes its success to endless repeating these anti-German propaganda programs. Any modification or revision of this carefully cultivated image of the Germany as the evil monster of history, and particularly as the evil victimizer of the Jews, would threaten the entire Holocaust story. Therefore, this image is jealously and carefully guarded by the Jewish-controlled press and information media, and woe upon anybody who desires to question it. Anyone who does so is immediately attacked and smeared as a deranged anti-Semite. The Jews are also unwilling to relinquish, or even to moderate their quest for revenge. Old Mercy, who has suffered all their lives as fugitives, are still tracked down as war criminals, and either brought to justice or summarily murdered on the spot. They call it vengeance. The only crime these old men may be guilty of was being an officer or a soldier in the German army during the war. But why, one might ask, amidst all the carnage, death, and destruction that occurred during World War II, has the so-called Holocaust emerged as a century atrocity story? Approximately 55 million people died during the war, only a tiny percentage of them Jews. Surely only a fraction of the 6 million claimed. All other combatants' nationalities have long since put the war behind them and have tried to make peace with their former enemies, but not the Jews. Two-thirds of a century has gone by, but the Jews are still nourishing their grievances, still building Holocaust museums and memorials at various governments' expense, incidentally, and still investigating new ways to extort money out of the various countries as compensation. But why should only the Jews be compensated? Scores of millions of other people across Europe lost everything in the war. The Holocaust has evolved over the years to become the national myth of the Jewish people, with all the characteristics of a religion, complete with its own Satan. Holocaust myth is the glue that holds the Jewish people together as a distinct nationality. And because of that, they carefully guard it and protect it. As a consequence, the poor Germans are consigned in perpetuity to the role of history's evil monster, regardless of what the actual facts may be. But even if all the stories of the German atrocities during World War II were true in every detail, they would still not compare in the inhumanity to the atrocities committed against the Germans. The indiscriminate saturation bombing of German cities, the brutal expulsion of entire German populations after the war, The Allied imposed post-war deprivations. The Soviet massacres and political liquidations simply dwarf the Holocaust in their destruction of human life and their destruction of the accumulated works of human civilization. Any final accounting and balancing of the conduct of all combatants during World War II could only result in the exculpation of Germany as uniquely barbarous in her methods of waging war or in her treatment of subject populations. The German people were devastated by the war to a greater extent than any other participant, including the Jews, while at the same time they have been stigmatized as the evil perpetrators of the war. They have been made to pay a terrible price for the atrocities during World War II, which may never have occurred, or at least never occurred to the extent alleged. It has become clear as time goes by that the Germans were the real victims of World War I and II, and continue to be. Now, just reading the preface, a lot of people will run to the brush and don't want to hear this. They've been propagandized, and we all have, to a great extent, more than we can even imagine. And it goes back to that mightier than the nuclear bomb, the lie is Satan's most powerful weapon. The bomb merely devastates. The lie steals souls. It enlists millions of naive people to Satan's cause. A lie. And we can go, I want to relate a lie to a modern that's happened 18 years ago. And it was 9/11. That was on 9/11. Now, I can say this earnestly and honestly through the investigations that I have made. There's not one thing our big brother has told us about 9/11 is the truth. There's not one bit of truth. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go there. But it's our modern day Holocaust. What a lie. Look at the lie that they have produced with 9/11. Instead of focusing on the Germans and all the misinformation that's been put on us, let's focus on the lie and what it does to us. Now, the reason I wanted to do this broadcast again, you know, there's about 30 chapters in the book. And, you know, when I got a hold of this book, it was like any other book. It was something different than any other book. I couldn't put it down. I read it in about 3 days, and I've read it twice. And matter of fact, this morning I was reading parts of it for the third and fourth time. Because, listen, when we don't shake off a lie and propaganda, we're not like ducks, where we get out of the water and shake and we're dry. That isn't how it works. Now, I chose a chapter to share that we've all heard about. It's the 1936 Olympics. Now, it's on the I didn't pick a subject where it was going to cause a lot of controversy. I picked a subject a chapter out of the book that was, you know, there was no violence in it, but everything they reported about it was a lie. And matter of fact, after you hear this chapter, after reading this chapter, I went up on the internet and I did a lot of research, watched everything I could get and find on Jesse Owens. And I'll tell you, the last story that I'm going to tell you brought me tears. I guess I can tell it right now. Jesse Owens is a receiver of four gold medals. The last one he got, no, that wasn't the last one. It was the third one he got. But the broad jump he was disqualified. He was going over the step, in other words, so it disqualified the jump. And he was down to his last jump. And the German that placed second coached Jesse, said, "Jesse, just take an extra step one way or other," whatever he coached him. And Jesse Owens set a world record that lasted for years. And after he did, the German put his arm around Jesse, and Jesse put his arm around the German, and they paraded around the stadium. And the Germans went nuts for Jesse Owens when he would come out. They, you know, Jesse, how do you say that in German? But the whole crowd. And you say, "Walt, you're telling a pretty good story." Well, you can find this on the internet. In 1953, Jesse Owens went back to Berlin because the stadium was not destroyed. The stadium was on the outskirts of Berlin. And it was on the outskirts of Berlin. And so the Germans invited him back in 1953 to a packed stadium. And he took a victory lap around with the Germans, clapping and pray, you know. You see, and so now, that's a little story before I read out of chapter 15, 1936 Olympics, by the author Benton L. Bradbury. And here it is. Berlin won the bid on April 1931 to host the 1936 Olympic Games over Barcelona, its number one contender. The bid for the Games had been won 2 years before the Nazis were elected into office in Germany. When the Nazis came to power, American Jewish organizations immediately demanded that some other venue be chosen for the Games other than Berlin. The American Jewish Congress and the Jewish Labor Committee staged rallies to oppose the Americans' participation in the Games if the Games were not moved out of Berlin. Avery Brundage, president of the American Olympic Committee, to his very great credit, decided despite this pressure that America would participate in the Games in Berlin as scheduled. International Jewry already had a propaganda campaign underway against the Nazis long before they came into office, and Brundage took the view that the attempted boycott of the Olympic Games was just another Jewish communist conspiracy against Germany, which, of course, it was. He stated that the Jewish athletes were not being treated unfairly in any way by anyone. The Jews were nevertheless relentless. The story most repeated about Hitler and the Olympic Games in Berlin is that Hitler refused to shake the hands of the American black athlete Jesse Owens after he had won the race. This myth is widespread and appears, in fact, in many journals and publications today, including, for example, in the Microsoft Encyclopedia. What actually happened is that Hitler personally attended the first day of the track and field competition on August 2, 1936. And personally congratulated the German athlete Hans Volk, who was the first German to win a gold medal in the Olympics since 1896. Throughout the rest of the day, Hitler continued to receive Olympic champions, both German and non-German, in the VIP box. The next day, August 3rd, the chairman of the International Olympic Committee, Comte Bailey Latour, approached Hitler only in the morning and told him that he had violated Olympic protocol by personally congratulating each Olympic winner. Hitler duly apologized and said that he would henceforth refrain from shaking the hands of the winners. Later in the same day, when Jesse Owens won his gold medal, Hitler did not shake his hand, or anybody else's, during the remainder of the Games. It is, therefore, utterly false to claim that Hitler deliberately chose to snub his autobiography, the Jesse Owens story, 1970. Owens recounted how Hitler had stood up and waved to him. Quote, "When I passed the chancellor," he wrote, he arose, waved his hand at me, and I waved back at him. I think the writers showed bad taste in criticizing the man of the hour in Germany." End of quote. During the afternoon of the first day, Hitler and his entourage left the stadium early because rain threatened. In fact, it had already begun to sprinkle. Coincidentally, the American black Cornelius Johnson had just barely beaten the American teammate in the high jump to win a gold medal shortly before Hitler left the stadium. The anti-German propagandists reported through the international Jewish press that Hitler, quote, had stormed out of the stadium in a tantrum because a black man had won an event. Hitler was much too sensitive to world opinion to have left himself open to negative publicity by any such inappropriate behavior. But the facts would never stand in the way of a good anti-Nazi story. The Jewish-owned New York Times carried on its front page, "Hitler grants all medalists, greets all medalists except Americans," the day after the first. And they, by the way, you can get this PDF file, this book. You can go to my page, Grand Design Exposed, scroll down, and you'll see a picture of the book, and just click on that, and then you can get a PDF file of this, what I'm reading here, or you can purchase the book. It was in the Baltimore African American newspaper, August 1936. Adolf snubs U.S. lads. Hitler won't shake hands. Hitler greets, the day after first. Anyway, let me get back. York Times carried on its front page, "Hitler greets all medalists except Americans the day after first competitive events." The headline for read, "Hitler ignores Negro medalists." Not by coincidence, the New York Times had earlier led the movement to boycott the Berlin Games. Other newspapers picked up on the story, "Hitler snubs Jesse." Read the huge, bold headlines of the black Cleveland paper Call and Post. The Baltimore African America carried the headlines, quote, "Adolf snubs U.S. lads." These were deliberate lies. Nothing of the kind happened. Remember what I said about 9/11. Everything that we heard by the mass media didn't happen. Two buildings did turn to dust and fall on their tracks. Now, that's a fact. But everything else they told us was just like this, were the deliberate lies. Nothing of the kind happened on 9/11. Same thing. A lie is a lie. It's Satan's. Remember that the lie is Satan's most powerful weapon. When somebody says something about another person or anything else and it's a lie, it's devastating in many cases. Back to the article now. Another story spread around about the 1936 Olympics by the anti-German press was that Owens' victory disproved that Nazi master race theory. If anything, the Games supported that idea, if, in fact, such an idea even existed. Germany won 89 medals, while the United States, with 2.5 times Germany's population, won 56. I didn't know this. I believed everything. Hitler was a Satan. He was a monster. And listen, he wasn't a Cub Scout, okay? But it shows you when lies are put into our heads, it causes, it changes public opinion. And when you got the power to change public opinion, you got more power than the canon. because if they won 89 medals, like you said, and if that was the case, they were the better country, you know. But anyway, let's get back to the article. That Germany claimed to be the master race is another myth with no basis in fact. Just more anti-German propaganda from the international Jewish press. The Nazis never made any claim, though the Jews do claim to be God's chosen people. And Hitler never used the term master race or anything close to it to describe the German people. Hitler used the term Aryan to represent all the Germanic peoples of Europe, including British, Dutch, Swedes, Norwegians, Finns, Swiss, and all other peoples of Europe of the Germanic origin. There was 40 different races in the German army. 40 different races. Okay. Hitler believed that the Aryan people were culturally superior to most of the rest of the mankind, as manifested in all their achievements. He wrote in Mein Kampf, "All the human culture, all the results of art, science, and technology that we see before us today are almost exclusively, he said almost exclusively, the creative product of the Aryan. This idea was generally accepted by all Europeans at that time and could hardly be disputed given the fact that almost all civilization's advances were accomplished by these people. The British have always considered themselves to be a superior race. The anti-German international Jewish press deliberately misinterpreted these general concepts to mean that the Germans considered themselves alone to be the master race. In fact, no such claim was ever made." And what was to become an act of extreme irony, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, then running for re-election and concerned about the reactions of the southern states, refused to see Jesse Owens at the White House. Owens was later to remark that it was Roosevelt, not Hitler, who snubbed him. Jesse Owens was a citizen of a country whose racism would have made Hitler blush. It's Hitler's Germany. Jesse Owens could share a bus or a tram ride with white people, treated equally in all respects before the law. He could sit in a movie theater next to whites, use public toilets, dine in the restaurants, and stay in hotels without any discrimination being shown towards him. There were many things he could do in Hitler's Germany that were forbidden at home in the United States. In the United States, black athletes were required to eat separately from the white fellow athletes. If they were allowed to share the same hotel at all, which was unlikely, it would be necessary for them to use the service entrance. There was no blacks on any major league baseball team, and there was no black swimmers. This was in the enlightened North. In the southern states, there was no possibility of a black allowed to participate in any sport except to compete with other blacks. For the Jewish press to have smeared Hitler and the German people in general as racist was hypocritical in the extreme. Jesse Owens evidently enjoyed his time in Hitler's Germany immensely. In Germany, he received a lot of pre-Olympic media hype, and the German people idolized him. Once at the stadium, the mere appearance of Jesse Owens heard from the pit below the stands could cause sections of crowds to break out in the chants of "Jesse Owens, Jesse Owens." This was Richard D. Mandel in the Nazi Olympics. Another quote from Richard D. Mandel. Some mornings at the Olympic Village, the athlete hero of 1 hour was awakened by an amateur photographers who flocked outside his bedroom window to click at the athlete before he could gather poise for one of his many appearances before the mobs in Berlin. Jesse Owens, quote from Lawrence M. Snyder, Jesse's coach, in the Saturday Evening Post, November 7, 1936. Jesse Owens was cheered as loudly as any Aryan. When Jesse Owens first returned to the States, he denied that he had been snubbed by Hitler or that he had been mistreated in any way. But he learned soon enough that he could use the snub myth to his own advantage. In his post-war interviews, post-war public addresses, and in his ghosted articles and books, he began to claim that Hitler had indeed refused to shake his hand, and he also began to repeat the lie that Hitler left the stadium in a tantrum. When black athletes won a medal, because that is what people wanted to hear. As he discovered that anti-Hitler stories resonated well with the American audience, he began to exaggerate his mistreatment stories even further. Such exaggerations finally became the central feature of his talks, as he described how emotionally torn apart he was by the snubs and other mistreated by Hitler and the Nazis. The reality is that Jesse Owens was given the warmest ovation of his life by German spectators, including Hitler. Yet another myth still commonly believed as the result of the anti-German propaganda is that American blacks ran away with the gold medals during the Berlin Games. It is true that Owens won 4 gold medals, but outside of track and field, Germans dominated the Olympic Games of 1936 by winning more medals than all other participants combined. These are only some of the flagrant distortions about Nazi Germany created by the International Jewish Propaganda Campaign. Since the victors write the historic accounts of events, Nazi Germany has been permanently smeared with the blatant false stories. Hitler's film expert to the National Socialist Party, in the quote, Lena Reinstahl, made a document to the 1936 Olympic Games called Olympia, which nearly matched her early film, The Triumph of the Will, in its propaganda value to the Third Reich. The film won international awards. She lived to be 100 years old. She's another interesting lady to her story. It shows in the book here, it shows a picture of her on top of the stadium there shooting the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. Germany scored a huge propaganda coup with the 1936 Olympic Games. Despite all efforts of the international Jewish press to denigrate it, the world was able to see firsthand the new Germany, which had been created by Nazi rule. German hospitality won high praise from visitors from all over the world, and Adolf Hitler was seen as the man of the hour, despite efforts being made by the international Jewry to discredit Nazi Germany in every way possible. Most objective reports were favored to Germany as a result of the games. Friedrich Birchall. It shows a picture of Hitler at the games, and it shows a picture of the stadium. I thought that was really interesting. Friedrich Birchall reported in the New York Times that the games put Germany back in the fold of nations and even made them more human again. But Jewish reporters consistently took only the most sinister interpretation of everything occurring in Germany. The Jewish journalist William Shire, for example, regarded the Berlin glitter on display for the world to see as merely a hiding a menace, a racist, militaristic regime. I'm afraid the Nazis have succeeded with their propaganda, he wrote. First, the Nazis have run the games on a lavish scale never before experienced, and this appealed to the athletes. Second, the Nazis have put up a very good front for the general visitors, especially the big businessmen. The most well-intentional and even the most praiseworthy activities of the Germans were seen by Shire and other Jewish reporters only as a front. The Jewish propaganda of that time was designed to smear and discredit Germany and the Nazis, not to present an accurate picture of actual events. Every event was deliberately twisted in the Jewish press to mean something it didn't. Every word and gesture of Hitler or any Nazi was deliberately misinterpreted to cast them in the worst possible light. Their motives were attributed to every act and deed. When Hitler behaved in a courteous, considerate, statesmanlike manner, it was reported to the Jewish press that he was wearing a false face and that he was cynically manipulating world opinion for his own sinister purposes. Despite all that is now known to be true about the circumstances surrounding the 1936 Olympic Games, especially the personal conduct of Hitler himself, Jewish writers and historians continue even to this day to trot out the same old propaganda lies of 1930 and 40. This fellow's name is, his name is Shirley Povich. He lived from July 15th of 1905 to June 4th of 1998. Jewish sports writer for the Washington Post newspaper. A good example of this article written by the Jewish sports writer Shirley Povich for the Washington Post on July 6, 1996, titled Berlin 1936. At the Olympics, Achievements of the Brave in a Year of Cowardice, this article was written to commemorate the sixth anniversary of the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games. In parentheses, it is worth mentioning that the Washington Post is a Jewish-owned newspaper and was enthusiastic participant in the international Jewish smear campaign against Germany during the 1930s and 40s. The Washington Post also participated in the effort to boycott the Berlin Olympic Games. He begins his article by writing, quote, "It is about the 1936 Olympics in Berlin that Adolf Hitler turned into a sickening pageant of Nazi propaganda. Supported by submissive U.S. Olympic officials and craven American track and field coaches who, like Nazi cousins, kicked their only two Jewish athletes off the 4x100-meter relay team. And it is about Hitler's snub of the American victorious black Olympians in their triumph." Povich's description of the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin is simply astonishing in view of what is known to be the real story about the Games today. The Nazis were defeated and destroyed in 1945. Yet half a century later, posthumous Jewish anti-German propaganda campaign continues unabated. In the article, he repeats the lie that our own Jewish athletes were kicked off the team in order to placate Hitler. He also reports that the lie that Hitler snubbed Jesse Owens and other black athletes. He preposterously states that Hitler, quote, already had the killing of 6 million Jews in his mind. He wrote that Germany did not permit German Jews to participate in the games. That was a lie. The Jewish Helen Mayer, for example, was a member of the German fencing team. In the article, Povich accused Avery Brundage, head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, of cowardice for refusing to participate in the attempted boycott of the Olympic Games. Povich claims that prominent Catholic, Protestant, as well as Jewish individuals and groups in the United States were loudly clamoring for a boycott, as were, he says, trade unions and civil organizations. That was not true. The campaign to boycott the Olympics was a purely Jewish campaign. Catholics and Protestants had nothing to do with it and did not support it. Trade unions did not support it, but trade unions were totally dominated and controlled by. Povich states that in the article, Germany was humiliated by American black athletes. In reality, Germany, at less than half the population of the United States, won 89 medals to America's 56. Povich claims that two Jews were removed from the American team simply because they were Jews. Not so. The two Jews that were removed were replaced by two black athletes who outperformed them. Povich's article was a reiteration of the blatant anti-Nazi propaganda spewed out of the Jewish-controlled media during the Nazi era, without a word of truth in it. The article totally mischaracterizes events as they actually occurred. Yet his version of events has become the official history of the 1936 Olympic Games, the history taught to the children in school. Now, you might not have caught, two black athletes did on the relay team when they won the gold medal, Jesse did, and another runner. They wanted the fastest athletes, and so they replaced two Jews with two black athletes. And so you've seen in the article how they turned that. Now listen, I didn't preview this book to cause dissension. But when you understand 9/11, you're going to understand the myth of German villainy. Because everything we've heard about World War II, I am a baby boomer, and I was raised I got my history from Hollywood, the movies and the TV, and the Audie Murphy movies that were made, and the John Wayne movies, and on, and they, you know, they made them for years. Now, I read chapter 15, but in this book. And you can get the PDF file off my webpage. You know it's full of pictures, and it's got, I'm looking here, it's got 23 chapters. You know, and it's I read again this morning. I want to just read the titles of the first four chapters. The Myth of Germany as an Evil Nation. 2 is Aftermath of the War in Germany. 3 is the Jewish Factor in the War. 4 is the Russian Revolution of 1917. And I'll tell you, I reread that chapter this morning, and it takes your breath away. It literally takes your breath away when you realize how they've covered up the history of the Bolsheviks. All we heard is Germany, Germany. Now there's a word. I'm gonna make sure I'm giving you the right spelling on this here. The word is Holomar, and I think I'm gonna make sure I'm giving you the right spelling. Okay, it's kind of hid too. Ukraine. Oh, yeah, this is the way it's spelled. It's spelled Holomar, H-O-L-O-D-O-M-R. No, M-O-R, Holomar, Holdamar, H-O-L-O-D-O-M-O-R. Now, I'm using this as an example, and I've kind of turned him around a little bit because all he wanted to do was hammer the Germans. And so you can ask anybody. You can ask anybody in the streets, even our children, even in public schools, what the Holocaust was. But if you ask, do you know what the Holomar was? See, they can. That's why it's bigger than just a race of people. When you can control public opinion by controlling their education, you can control a population, and it's not done with guns. But the Holomar, it's here what it says in right here. Holomar, also known as the terror famine genocide in the Ukraine, and before the widespread use of the term Holomar, and sometimes currently also referred to as the Great Famine. And the Ukrainian genocide of 32, it was the winter of 32 and 33. They were collectivizing the farms. See, the Ukraine is the breadbasket of Russia. And they were forcing collectivization. In other words, they didn't do it in 1 year. They first put quotas on the farmers. In other words, if they produced 100 pounds of grain, they had to give 30 to the government. 5 years to get this famine to where it fired. Every year they upped the ante. Instead of taking 30%, and the very last year they practically took everything from them. And they made them collectivize their animals. In other words, if you had two horses and two cows, you had to take it to the collectivized barn, and it was no longer your animal. And of course, what this caused is it caused a down, less animals were being produced because they weren't being taken care of right. And so in 32 and 33, I read a book by a survivor. He was 12 years old, and he survived the famine. And they figure that anywhere from 9 to 11 million people perished in a winter. And the reason I bring this up is, again, to really a lot of people cannot digest this book. They can't digest it. In other words, because from get-go, there's no other country in the world that has been propagandized more than the United States, or some call it psychological warfare. And to take over a nation, all you have to do is take their history away. But to end this broadcast, now I played that song at the beginning, you know, about the country bunking. Listen to it this time. There's three stages. The man meets, he was just a country bunking, and he meets his wife. And then another miracle, they had a son. Now she was not only his wife, but she was a mother. 40 years later, you know, when she was on her deathbed, she said goodbye to her country pumpkin. Life, what makes life difficult is learning upon learning. And the computer age that we live in has not helped things. People don't enjoy the simple things in life. Getting away by packing a lunch and going out and having a picnic. You go through towns and cities now, you don't see any children on the streets. They're in there playing games. Or if they're walking down the street, they got their head into their smartphone. People have walked right out in front of traffic and been killed. We live in an age that we get the simple things in life are free. And you married men, you know, it's a battle. And your wife is a blessing. Because the world has turned the women upside down. What's that done to the man? When I was married, I got most of my strength, not physical strength, is from my wife. And I'll tell you, when all of a sudden it disappeared, I realized that I depended on that. That wasn't just me. That wasn't just my wife. It's in the whole culture. So listen, this is a book review, and most people will run from the preface of the book. But I'm going to play this song. I want to say too, from Monday to Friday, we're going to have the topic is going to be the Bible. From 9 to 10 Pacific Standard Time, we're going to go through the Bible. We're going to read the New Testament. But until then, I'll see you tomorrow. And let this little song play in my heart.
He walked into the bar and parked his lanky frame upon a tall bar stool. And with a long, soft southern drawl, said, I'll just have a glass of anything that's cool. A barroom girl with hard and knowing eyes slowly looked him up and down. And she thought, I wonder how on earth that country bumpkin found his way to town. She said, hello, country bumpkin, how's the frost out on the pumpkin? I've seen some sights, but man, you're something. Where'd you come from, country bumpkin? It was just a short year later, in a bed of joy filled tears, yet death like pain. Into this wondrous world of many wonders, one more wonder came. That same woman's face was wrapped up in a raptured look of love and tenderness. As she marveled at the soft and warm and cuddly boy child feeding at her breast. She said, hello, country bumpkin, precious frost out on the pumpkin. I've seen some sights, but babe, you're something. Mama loves her country bumpkin. 40 years of hard work later, in a simple, quiet, and peaceful country place. The heavy hand of time had not erased the raptured wonder from the woman's face. She was lying on her deathbed, knowing fully well her race was nearly run. But she softly smiled and looked into the sad eyes of her husband and her son. She said, so long, country bumpkin, the frost is gone now from the pumpkin. I've seen some sights and life's been something. See you later, country bumpkin. She said, so long, country bumpkin, the frost is gone now from the pumpkin. I've seen some sights and life's been something.